I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This is the second half of our interview with Stephen Eric Bronner about his book, Reclaiming the Enlightenment, Towards a Politics of Radical Engagement. Dr. Bronner is a professor of political science at Rutgers University. Part of the critique of the Enlightenment by conservative intellectuals in the wake of communism has been that, and this was also a critique of the counter-Enlightenment after the French Revolution, was that if you give these radical intellectuals who want to reorder society in the name of reason any power, they're going to unleash these terrors of trying to organize everybody's lives in these totalitarian ways. And I think you see that critique reflected in, or perhaps originating from the dialectic of Enlightenment, where they were trying to grapple with what the unpleasant ramifications are of thorough rationalization of society. So, do you dismiss the notion that Marxist-Leninism is in some ways a fulfillment of one aspect, one of the memes within the Enlightenment of this kind of perfect rationality inflicted on society to the exclusion of other important values of the Enlightenment, such as liberty?
If I could just say, to me, the argument breaks down because, if only because, the Soviet Union was never a rational fulfillment of anything, especially when we get to Stalin and Stalinism. Although this begins by 1922 or 1923, at any rate, by the time you get to Stalinism, even the greatest historian of Marxism, somebody like Blaise Kolakowski, who's as critical as you could be, basically said there was no coherence to Stalin's statements at all. And there no longer was a theory to speak of. Theory meant what Stalin's theory was what Stalin said at any given moment. From the other end of the spectrum, with regard to fascism, I think, it's quite clear that Hitler and the Nazis and the conservative revolution in Germany and in Italy during the late 1920s were directly opposed to liberalism, democracy, and so on. If I were to say what is the Marxist continuation of the Enlightenment, I would simply say social democracy. I think it would be very, very difficult to argue about that. Whether one looks at reformers, like famous Edward Bernstein, orthodox Marxists, person was called the Pope of Marxism prior to World War I, Karl Kautsky, or Rosa Luxemburg, who wrote a little biography about this, is actually still in print after 30 years. All three of these people opposed one another, but they were all arguing within an Enlightenment frame of reference that highlighted democracy with civil liberties, that highlighted highlighted internationalism, then that, highlighted a humane redistribution of wealth, and who opposed terror and the arbitrary exercise of power by the state.
And of course, Maoism would be even further removed from.
I'm sorry?
Maoism would have been even further removed.
Yeah, even further removed.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It seems to me that the way you can tell whether the enterprise stands in coherent relation to Enlightenment principles is really, at the end of the day, relatively simple. Is the state acting in an arbitrary manner, or isn't it? That's the first question I think you ask.
So you think that
dealing with politics,
the arbitrariness is a sign of the whether reason is a guiding principle in public policy.
Right. And whether the public good is the primary concern, that is to say, the state is treating individuals equally under the rule of law, and so on.
Okay, now let's get back to the dialectic of Enlightenment. Horkheimer and Adorno say rationality unleashed is going to have some pernicious effects on the quality of our lives, and we have to rethink our commitment to the Enlightenment so that we don't unleash these pernicious effects. Is that I know you can't summarize the argument that
way. That's sort of a tough thing to summarize in a sense. Let me see if I can do it a little, give it a little more flesh. For Adorno and Horkheimer, the historical Enlightenment is sort of the crystallization of Western civilization. And what they believe is that Western civilization was predicated on the domination of nature and the attempt in some way to, if you want to put it this way, the attempt to create institutions that would deny subjectivity. In other words, individual experience. If you think of science, there's no room for how you feel about something. The law of gravity is the same in China or in the United States or wherever. Subjectivity plays no role. In trying to extend that idea of science to social life, Horkheimer and Adorno essentially believed that subjectivity was denied. And with the denial of subjectivity comes the inability for people to exercise their conscience, since that too is in some way something extra scientific, extra operational, extra mathematical, and so on. And with that inability to exercise your conscience, with this dominant scientific rationality, comes an openness to totalitarian ideas, an inability to deal with a weakness, a flabbiness of liberal ideas and the like. And the result is a world, what they call a totally administered society, in which the individuality is essentially denied or manipulated. I think that's basically where they're coming from. So, and that's their emphasis on utopian experience, on aesthetics, on all that which elicits subjectivity against the ordering of society.
But this is also parallel to and then mixed up with the postmodern notion that this Enlightenment narrative of progress is squashing everybody's unique experiences and trying to create a homogeneity,
yeah.
Eurocentric.
And I think that they build that out of, for better or worse, they build that out of Horkheimer and Adorno. And the question is, does that make sense? And I don't think it really does make sense. It seems to me that we've become so preoccupied with subjectivity that we forget about the preconditions for solidarity. And we become so concerned with the expression of freedom that we no longer think about the kinds of institutions that can either facilitate the free exercise of subjectivity or constrain them. You basically wind up, I think, with Horkheimer and Adorno in A Night in Which All Cows Are Black. You can't see the difference any longer between regimes, between institutions, and between movements.
This really got crystallized for me back in the 1980s when, as a student organizer, I was talking to a young woman, and she was a socialist and a feminist activist. But when we were talking about something like female genital mutilation in East Africa, she absolutely refused to acknowledge the legitimacy of Western efforts to stop such a practice, because how could we possibly pass judgment on what people were doing in other parts
of
the world?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to put it this way, I mean, this is a more postmodern position. This is not
right.
A position, in fairness, that's not a position of...
That they would have adopted, right.
Yeah, but basically what we've gotten to today is a position, is a point at which sort of the abdication of judgment becomes the principle of judgment. And that's not a very healthy situation.
Right.
You know? So, and
I think there has to be a way for us to reaffirm universal moral principles, but in a chastened way that acknowledges that there is this history of Eurocentric application.
Indeed. Let's see if we can even use the example of this woman to whom you were talking. Now, to my mind, right, it's one thing to say female genital mutilation is a terrible thing. It's inhumane and it's barbaric. It's another thing for me to say that because I hate this, I'm going to invade the country I'm going to support an invasion of the country that's practicing this activity. When I don't know what the constraints are, I don't know the conditions, and I can produce an even greater barbarism than before. On some level, I can voice my opinion, but I have to engage in a politics that links the ends I want to achieve, a more humane world, with the practices I want to employ.
Right, the moral abstract argument is, if we could have invaded Rwanda and stopped the genocide, wouldn't it have been our moral obligation to do so? The practical political and military question is, could we possibly have ever done anything?
And to me, this is something I've gotten out of the Enlightenment. Maybe perhaps I've tried to develop it myself. It is that one has to make one's political judgments with an eye on objective conditions. In other words, it makes no sense simply to talk about ethics without reference to objective reality. It may be true that universal principles, ethical principles, aren't reducible to the constraints, interests, and problems, or prejudices, rather, that exist in objective reality. But there has to be some link between the two, no matter how indirect. And that I think is the way to proceed. That's why I say we have to have some kind of plausible connection between theory and practice and means and ends. Hmm. And we have to insist on that as leftists. There's no reason why people can't. I've done a lot of work with the Sudan and Darfur. I'm actually a chair of U.S. Academics for Peace. You can see anyone who is engaged in the battles that have taken place, genocidal issues that have occurred, you know that there are potentially genocidal issues that might occur. You know that there are real problems in the world, and you know that there are forms of exploitation and repression which are real. Whether you can solve them by simply exporting liberal ideals on bayonets, that's another matter. That has to be taken seriously.
Part of what you grapple with in Reclaiming the Enlightenment is the importance of revitalizing internationalism.
And, yes.
You know, with the decline of the Socialist International as a, well, it was never the political force of the Comintern, for instance. And then the decline of world federalism after World War II. I mean, there are still some world federalists in my neighborhood here, but they're all like 70 years old. So it's waned as a political force. I've always been a world federalist. I've always been a fan of these transnational mm-hmm. institutions, but it's
an idea that actually comes from Kant.
Really?
Yeah.
At any rate, these ideas, you know, still seem to me to be quite relevant, but they've taken a real hit. Progressives aren't excited by the idea of transnational institutions. In fact, they usually fight them.
Yeah. I think your point's very well taken. In the book, what I tried to talk about, that's why I tried to talk about the idea of a cosmopolitan sensibility. In other words, what's very interesting about today is that the rudimentary institutional forms of internationalism exist. They exist in transnational organizations, whether it's the Organization of African Unity or it's the European Parliament or it's the UN. Those are already in place, or they're in place to a degree. What's interesting is how little loyalty they actually are able to accrue. And it seems to be one of the issues for activists and intellectuals today to begin to talk about how you can begin to think about this fostering this kind of loyalty. And so I try to introduce this idea of a cosmopolitan sensibility, which is not simply involved with international structures, but rather the, shall we say, the preconditions for thinking about a way in which, as Kant would say it, you can feel at home everywhere. And we can begin to build something new, or a new vision of an international society, out of identity concerns, religious traditionalism, and provincial forms of identification.
Do you think that you're beginning to see a little bit of that with internet activism?
I do.
Yeah. For instance, with the Iranian revolution.
I do. Yeah. The example I use in the book, I think, was actually from the arts. Around the turn of the century, most of the great painters went either to Africa or to Mexico or to Latin America or China or to Asia to fructify their vision. Now, one case was, a very famous one, was Paul Klee, the great Expressionist painter, went with his friend, another painter, named Carl Schmidt Rottluff, to Tunisia. And they went there, and what they noticed was that the light was completely different in Tunisia. So they began to paint, and they did watercolors, basically. And they came back to Munich, and they put on what came to be known as the African Light Exhibition. It was really, in a certain way, a breakthrough. But what's aesthetically, but for our purposes, what's important is the following. What they produced was neither really African art nor what was traditionally understood as European art, but something different, something new, something cosmopolitan. And that's what I think we should begin to envision. Instead of simply looking back to our roots, whatever those may be, in order and to the past and to how we were born and the conditions in which we were born for our feeling of belonging and identity and vitality, perhaps we can begin to look at look for vitality with a different frame of reference.
So you're saying
really begin to create something new.
Cultural cosmopolitanism is a precondition for the formation of the kind of political international political citizenship.
I think you're right. I think that's right. That's one of the arguments I wanted to put forward in the book. Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Well, that certainly ennobles many of my cultural passions. So.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Stephen Eric Bronner. He's a professor of political science at Rutgers University and the author of Reclaiming the Enlightenment Towards a Politics of Radical Engagement, and has written many other important works. For those of you who are following this Enlightenment theme on Change Stuff Radio, I highly recommend it. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. I appreciate your time.
This has been the second half of our interview with Stephen Eric Bronner, professor of political science at Rutgers University and the author of Reclaiming the Enlightenment, Towards a Politics of Radical Engagement. You can listen to the first half of the interview at IEET.org. My colleague at the IET, Mike Treader, is a much better blogger than I am. He's much more faithful to the daily writing habit. And his most recent blog post essay at the IET site, pretty funny, so I thought I'd read it here. "Life is not a science fiction story," says Mike Treader. "Many transhumanists are under the mistaken impression that the world they live in operates like a science fiction novel. It doesn't. This cognitive confusion seems to underlie some of the conflicts between moderate techno-progressives like me and the more exuberant types who expect that radical, wondrous changes are always just around the corner because they read it in a book. Don't get me wrong, I love reading science fiction. I find it fascinating, compelling, mind-expanding, and occasionally even well-written. But I try to remember the second word in that genre description, fiction. You see, the real world is not a story. It's not designed to be easily understood, to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. It doesn't have a moral. It cannot be edited to improve clarity and flow. The actual world we inhabit is complex, confused, arbitrary, random, chaotic, contingent, and messy. It's hardly the stuff of a best-selling novel, or at least not the kind that seems to incite such zeal among transhumanists who believe that what they read in a book or saw in a movie must be true. No, if real life was a science fiction story, it would be very different. For instance, space stations. If life was a science fiction story, then we would long ago have built bases on the moon, and huge space stations would orbit the Earth. Instead, we have a handful of people sitting inside a cramped, smelly, recycled garbage can that we call the International Space Station, and the moon has not felt a human footprint since 1972. Terraforming Mars. If life was a science fiction story, we already would be making serious plans to convert the planet Mars into a pleasant, inviting new home for humans. Massive funding would be available, the science would be comparatively simple, and the needed technologies would be obvious and easily developed. But life is not a science fiction story. The science of terraforming is difficult and contentious. The technology is dauntingly expensive. The politics of funding and decision-making are fraught with distractions. And so Mars just sits there, and nothing will happen for a long, long time. Nanobots. If life was a science fiction story, maverick genius scientists would be able to create powerful new technologies in their basement laboratories. Disrespected by their peers, they would go off on their own, assisted only by pimply geeks wearing glasses and beautiful blonde reporters who stumble onto the scene and fall in love with the protagonists, and they would do what the others said couldn't be done. They would invent it and prove the doubters and naysayers wrong. But life is not a science fiction story. Such things don't happen in the real world. Nanotechnology, or bioengineering, or computer intelligence, or whatever, is instead a slow, laborious, painstaking process that features many more failures than successes, many more dead ends than discoveries, and far too many boring step-by-agonizing-step procedures to make a good novel. Global warming. If life was a science fiction story, glaciers would melt a lot faster than they do in the real world, sea levels would rise at a visible rate, and mega hurricanes would form over the Atlantic so convincingly on radar screens that everyone would be forced to admit that scientists were right all along. In real life, of course, things are not so simple. Although the evidence is plain to anyone who examines it with an open mind, there's enough vagueness and noise within the data, science being what it is, to give room for skeptics to mount a campaign of distortion and obfuscation. Glaciers are melting, of course, and average temperatures continue to rise. We've just completed the warmest decade in history. But because we're not living in a science fiction story, there will be no sudden plot twist to change everything and hasten a dramatic conclusion. We will just continue to see arguments and counterarguments and political stasis, and not nearly enough concerted action. Supercomputing. If life was a science fiction story, giant banks of blinking megacomputers would unite in a misguided directive to save humans from themselves by taking control of all nuclear arsenals. It would be a totalitarian nightmare. But just in time, one boy would arrive to outsmart the smartest computer and save the day. Whew! In real life, meanwhile, supercomputers continue to grind away, working dispassionately and mindlessly on various disparate projects, which may or may not be to benefit to most of us, but which certainly don't have the makings of compelling story. AI. If life was a science fiction story, then human-equivalent artificial intelligence would have been achieved by now. Remember, it's been less than 10 years away for the last 50 years, and it would be guiding us on a manned mission to Jupiter. Except that we wouldn't be able to trust the AI from going nuts and trying to kill us, since it apparently wasn't programmed to be friendly. But that's only a story and not real life. And the singularity. If life was a science fiction story, the first and only instance of artificial general intelligence would immediately begin to rewrite and improve its own source code, seize the means of manufacturing and energy production, and instigate such rapid advances in computing and everything else that the world as we know it would almost immediately cease to exist. Since life is not a story, however, it seems almost inevitable that the development of AI will take a more mundane course, and that any discernible technological singularity will proceed slowly enough that humans will somehow muddle through. Ho-hum. Have I made my point? Can you see the huge differences between science fictional world and the actual world? Well, let me give one more example. Time travel. If life was a science fiction story, transhumans of the future would be so angered by my cynicism that they would construct a time machine, come back to 2010, and stop me from writing in That's Life is Not a Science Fiction Story by Mike Treader. And just to leave you with a little news from the IET, we've appointed three new fellows at the IET. Annalita is one of our fellows. She is the director of the Opignani Bioethics Center and is a representative of the American Humanist Association to the United Nations. She's accepted appointment as a fellow. David Brin, the distinguished science fiction author, many books that have been inspiring for those of us who address these kind of topics, for instance, his Uplift series, The Star Tide Rising and The Uplift War, about the relationship between humans and chimpanzees and dolphins that we've modified to be more intelligent. And our third new fellow is Dr. Patrick Lin, director of the Ethics and Emerging Sciences Group at California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo. He's accepted appointment as an IET fellow. He has been the co-editor on volumes such as Nanoethics, The Ethical and Social Implications of Nanotechnology, and an anthology on robot ethics forthcoming from MIT Press. He's the author, co-author of a book, What is Nanotechnology and Why Does It Matter? From the Science to the Ethics, and has been working on a number of government-funded reports and projects, one for the Office of Naval Research on Autonomous Military Robotics. So we're very happy to welcome Patrick and Anna and David as new fellows of the IET. We also have appointed the faculty of the bioethics cruise that we're doing with the Apignani Bioethics Center and the University of Montreal Bioethics Center with Dr. Beatrice Godard up there. So with the four of us, Beatrice, myself, Mike Treader, and Annalita, will be supplemental faculty on the cruise to the Bahamas, the bioethics cruise, October 10 to 17, 2010. But we have three principal faculty, Dr. Michael West, who will be addressing the topic of life extension research, Dr. Dietrich Stefan, who will be addressing the topic of personalization of medicine and treatments, the personalized medicine diagnosis theme, and Professor Martha Farah, who is a neuroethicist, one of the founders of American Neuroethics, and she teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. So we're very happy to welcome Dr. West, Dr. Stefan, and Dr. Farah on the cruise with us, and we expect to learn quite a bit. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.